Contained herein are the heresies of Radolf Burntwine, erstwhile monk-turned-traveling medical investigator. Join me as I uncover the blasphemous truth of a plague-ridden world, that ours is not a loving God, and we are not its favored children. The Heresies of Radolf Burntwine, coming January 2nd, wherever podcasts are available.
Mike needed a place to hide, and I helped him find it. My family moved to Sioux Falls, Iowa when I was in 7th grade, which is how Mike and I met. We were neighbors. We lived on Crestwood Drive, a dead-end street near the north end of town. It ran down a long hill that ended with a gentle curve through a wooded area, like a slide into the untamed wilderness. Mike's house was near the top of the hill, and mine was sort of in the middle across from his. Smartphones were a thing, but at that time, kids our age were rarely given one. It was like 2008 or 2009. I think I might have had a flip phone then, but I honestly don't remember. Mike was my only friend, and we had our own system of communication. I'll tell you about it in a little while. Mike told me the first of his big secrets that first summer living on Crestwood Drive. His father, with whom he lived alone, frequently hit him. And maybe once or twice a month, he would really beat Mike. I'll spare you the details because, honestly, as I've grown up, I've realized just how horrific and sad the abuse really was. When you're a kid, it's just like, oh, that sucks, man. Only later would I realize how poorly I handled the situation. I know I should have told my parents. Let's just get that out of the way now. I know I should have, but I didn't. And for that, I'll always bear some shame. There was also this weird dynamic with Mike's dad. Like, besides hitting him, he took good care of Mike. And it sounds like he never hurt Mike's sister, who had already graduated high school and left by the time I showed up. Mike loved his dad. He really did. He just didn't love the abuse. It was complicated. Mike always thought the reason he got hit and not his sister was because his mom died giving birth to him. I guess that could have been it, but I was always suspicious it was something else. I mean, it could have been a multitude of things, really. Who says there had to be just one factor? But Mike had another secret. Back then, Mike showed certain characteristics. The way he talked, some of his interests, even the way he carried himself. I kinda wondered if he was gay even then. Remember, this was 08 or 09. Coming out didn't make you some big hero. It got you a very different kind of attention, and I wonder if that's why his dad hit him. Maybe he was trying to make him man up or something. When Mike first told me about the beatings, I told him he should just run away to my house whenever his dad got angry. He thanked me but said he didn't want my parents to know what was going on because he didn't want to get taken away from his dad. And idiot I was. I listened to him. His logic made sense to me, I guess. But I knew better than to just let my friend suffer. I told him he should hang this hot pink t-shirt we both got at a youth summer camp from his bedroom window whenever his dad was in one of those moods. That way, I would know to make some excuse to go meet him outside. The problem was, we didn't really have anywhere to go from there. We could have hid out in my backyard, if I had one. Since we lived on a hill, my house backed up to a pretty steep mud cliff that was always a sloppy mess. But if we stayed out on the street, Mike said his dad would see him and call him in, and then it wasn't an option. We ended up wandering into the woods at the bottom of the hill just to stay out of sight, and that's where we found our hiding place. Put yourself in the shoes of a middle school boy and imagine our delirium when we stumbled upon a battered cabin buried deep in the woods. We called it a cabin anyway. In hindsight, it was more like a cinder block shed. It had windows. They'd been broken out long before we found it, but there were a million rotted holes in the roof anyway, so it's not like they were doing any good. Little did I know, the cabin was part of a property situated on the other side of the hill, but it was obvious no one had used it for a long, long time. The door was padlocked with a rust-encrusted lock I don't think would have opened even with the key. We busted the rotten frame out of one of the windows and climbed in that way. Even as we climbed through the window, we were brushing away stringy cobwebs. You know, the kind that snap like tiny streamers when you tear at them. Sunlight streaming in lit up sections of the multi-layered webs, but there were a multitude of shadowy corners where spiders, possibly quite big ones, could hide and wait. The color-drained shells of their victims hung everywhere, like litter left behind in a park. We were lucky to find a bent rake near the window and used it to tear down the webs. We weren't accosted by arachnids after all. We did find a skeleton, though, of a rodent. It could have been a rabbit, squirrel, or maybe a young raccoon or a possum. Whatever it was, Mike scooped it up and flung it out the window. Its dry bones split apart and went every which direction as they cracked through the underbrush. The cabin didn't stink, luckily. I guess that animal died a while before we came along. That told me, if the webs hadn't provided enough evidence, the cabin had been abandoned for a very long time. Someone would have removed the rotting creature otherwise. For that reason, despite trespassing, I felt safe. There was a decaying 12-speed mountain bike near the door. We found it when scraping away cobwebs. While I had the rake, I knocked it around in the space between the ceiling and the top of an old metal locker, the single piece of furniture inside. The rake struck something soft. I knocked the thing off, curious what it was, and realizing only too late that it could have been another dead animal. A camo baseball cap fell right at my feet with a clap that echoed off the concrete floor. Mike dared me to put it on, and I called him crazy with all the spiders that were probably still hiding out around us. There might have been a big hairy one nested inside the sweatband. I did pick up the hat, though, and gave it a couple turns, searching for anything gross. Someone had written "Dusty" on the underpeak in permanent marker. I could barely make it out in the faint light. All the gray concrete and dust gave the musty air a bluish tint, almost like we were underwater. Having decided there was nothing living in the hat, I slapped it onto my head, which gave Mike a good laugh. "What, you dared me?" I said. He laughed. "Yeah, but you know I didn't mean it." I did know, and that was the fun of it. I didn't take the hat off and accidentally wore it home. Mike reminded me I was wearing it just after we said goodbye outside my house. I snatched the hat off my head and clutched it to my chest as if it were poignant evidence of a terrible crime and I needed to hide it. Mike laughed. Later, I tucked the hat away deep in my closet, and there it stayed for years. It'll come up again, though. Just wait and see. I've been trying to decide how to describe the loft. That's what we called it. Basically, someone had put particle board across the rafters, turning the inner triangle of the roof into a tiny room. There was no ladder, but there was a square cutout in the particle board that was clearly meant to allow someone up there. By boosting one another or using the rusty bike, we easily could have climbed up, but neither of us wanted to. What if there was a wild animal up there, or more spiders? There almost certainly would be. Bigger ones that jumped out at you. I conjured the possibility that there could even be a person hiding up there. "Do you really think so?" Mike asked me. I just shrugged. Mike yelled, "If anyone's hiding up there, you need to tell us right now." Of course, nobody answered. The next two or three times Mike put out the signal and snuck to the cabin with me, I was still pretty creeped out by it. I couldn't relax. But for Mike, the cabin was such a drastic improvement from home that I had to let my feelings go for his sake. We started making the cabin our own, which helped. We rode our bikes around to some yard sales and picked up a couple rickety lawn chairs, some posters, and a battery-powered lantern. Our presence forced out the spiders, too. They tend to like dark, quiet places, and Mike and I were determined to make our secret cabin just the opposite. I'm painting a pretty rosy picture because As I've started writing all this down, I've realized how much I don't want to talk about what Mike was going through. It was really awful. Like, I actually stole the first aid kit out of my parents' minivan to keep at the cabin for Mike. He mostly just showed up with bruises, but sometimes he'd have broken skin or a cut on his lip. I tried my best, but it's hard knowing how bad I screwed up back then. I mean, I'm lucky Mike's turning out as well as he is. He's off at West Point now, can you believe it? I guess he was always tough. Anyway, since the cabin was Mike's safe house, I learned to like it. If it kept him safe, which it did on many a cold evening, I loved it. Mike would go there alone sometimes when it was late and maybe he didn't want to bother me. I didn't find out about that until much, much later, and at first I was pretty mad, but then Mike explained why. I guess he knew how much, deep down, the cabin spooked me, and he didn't want to make me go at night. He told me, this was much later, mind you, that he would hear things at night that he did not hear during the day. When we were grown, Mike told me the first time he went to the cabin alone, he thought I was already there. He said he heard a footstep while he was still standing outside. Then, when he climbed in, he called my name, and there was a deep groaning sound from above. He said he couldn't believe that not only had I snuck out there by myself, I had actually worked up the nerve to go up to the loft. When he told me this story years later, he said he couldn't honestly say if the groan came from the boards or a voice. "Like a human voice?" I asked. He looked away, sort of embarrassed, but he nodded. "But who could it have been?" I asked. He didn't have an answer, of course, because if he did, the story would have begun like, "Hey, you'll never believe who I caught up in the loft today." The reason Mike hadn't even bothered to bring it up when we were kids was he never heard the noises when we were together. He figured it was just his juiced-up nerves from running out of the house that made him perceive normal noises as something they were not. Mike might have been right not to tell me about the groaning voice or whatever it was. I might never have gone back to the cabin because, although I'd never heard anything I would have called a voice, I heard other things. Taps, you could call them. Bumps, knocks. There are at least half a dozen terms for the sounds I would hear. The sounds I ignored. The thing is, especially when you're a young boy, when somebody hears a sound, somebody has to check it out. If nobody wants to, dares get involved. And where there's a dare, there's a risk of looking scared, or worse, weak. I always did the tough thing and just ignored that tingling on the back of my neck, the prickle of my ears, whenever something went bump. By high school, Mike and I were visiting the cabin less frequently. One reason was we simply had more stuff going on. I played baseball and football, and Mike led the school band's percussion section. We were both popular in our own circles and made a few good friends. But every now and then, I would glance out my window and see that hot pink shirt dangling out of Mike's window and make my way down to the cabin. I guess, at that point, with both of us going different directions socially, Mike became more like my brother than my friend. And like a good brother, I was always there when he needed me. Familiarity with the cabin made it less spooky to me in high school. Plus, I was just older. I stopped being afraid of things and started pretending I understood everything. Pick your coping cliche of choice. A teenager's life is full of cliches anyway. And that's what I would tell myself if ever anything creaked inside. Oh yeah, boards expand and shrink as the temperature changes. They pop and groan all the time. But that drastically changed the first time I tried to bring someone else to the cabin. I only made that mistake once. Melody and I started dating in 10th grade and kept going into 11th. I thought Mike and I's cabin could be a secret I shared with her too, now that Mike was around less. She was the one, you know? Or at least I thought so. I'm sure you remember how it felt the first time you fell in love. You were absolutely certain you found your soulmate on the first go. You were going to get married straight out of high school and start an amazing life together. Happily ever after, right? Well, I feel safe saying that is never the way it really goes. Melody and I, we took a sharp turn away from happily ever after the day I brought her to the cabin. I took her there to let her into a deeply personal part of my life and, by association, Mike's, and also to make out. Mostly to make out, I guess. Before the cabin revealed itself through those thick mossy trees, Melody and I heard someone blowing what could have been a train whistle, or, she thought, perhaps a harmonica. They weren't playing music, per se, just blowing into the thing like a boiling tea kettle. Melody asked if anyone else ever hung out in those woods, and I told her not ever since Mike and I had started hanging out there. We hadn't seen or heard another soul in the woods, unless you counted the disembodied noises that sometimes came from within the cabin itself. The blowing harmonica, after a minute we were both sure that's what it was, sounded distinctly out of place and had silenced all the nearby birds which normally made the woods feel so ambient and fairy tale-esque. Melody, having never experienced the woods as I knew them, wanted to go back. I hesitate to say that I pressured her to continue, but in hindsight, I guess that's exactly what I did. It makes me feel dirty recalling that moment, staring into her anxious blue eyes and pushing her to abandon her fear and follow me. But push I did, and she followed.
Hey there. Ever wonder what happens to all those amazing screenplays that never make it to the big screen? Well, wonder no more. Welcome to Table Read Podcast, where we bring those undiscovered gems to life. Picture this, talented actors giving incredible performances with the occasional laugh or blooper thrown in, produced by award-winning pros. From drama to comedy, TV pilots to feature films, there's something for everyone. And guess what? We release new episodes every week, so don't forget to hit that subscribe button. Table Read Podcast, where great stories finally get their chance to shine.
I entered the cabin through the window, as always, but as soon as I dropped down, I waved Melody away. Something felt wrong. I felt constricted, like all those dusty spiderwebs had returned, invisible to my eyes but perceptible by some undiscovered sense. For the first time, I felt unwelcome inside the cabin, like it didn't want me there anymore. I tried to reason with myself, with some success. I managed to convince myself I was experiencing guilt over sharing Mike and I's secret without his permission or knowledge. I was just about to whisper to Melody and tell her to come on in when the harmonica blasted a shrill note directly over my head. I believed that day as I spilled out of the cabin and rushed Melody out of the woods, and believed for 2 years afterwards that another person had discovered our hideaway. I thought someone braver than us had climbed into the loft and made it their home. I conjured this caricature of a train-hopping bum holding a sack over his shoulder with one hand and a harmonica to his lips with the other. He had hateful, desperate eyes. Eyes which would appear in my nightmares, staring down on me from darkness. When Melody dumped me about 2 months later, I drew a line right back to that day in the woods. That was the day she started distancing herself from me. Just a little at first, but even the following week, she had started pretending not to hear me calling her name in the halls. A few weeks before the breakup, I told Mike I had tried to take Melody to the cabin and about what we heard out there. He wasn't as mad as, well, I guess as mad as I had hoped he would be. He didn't really believe me either. He admitted he had heard the harmonica 2 or 3 times in the woods before, but never inside the cabin. He made a pretty compelling case that it was just nerves, but I didn't let him convince me. I was certain about what I heard, and adamant that I would not go back to the cabin again. Mike didn't put out his pink shirt for a month. I actually convinced myself that his dad must have finally gotten straight or stopped caring if Mike was gay. That's how far I bent reality to comfort myself during those weeks. Not that I thought of Mike very often at all. I was still trying to fix things with Melody. Two things made me rescind my veto on the cabin. First, the inevitable breakup. Something about it made me reckless for a while. I craved risks, and facing my nightmare hobo in the woods seemed weirdly appealing. Second, Mike turned up at school with a poorly disguised black eye. He'd done a better job disguising the injuries to his arms, but I still noticed them. And even though he would not meet my eyes, I could read his. He resented me, maybe even hated me. I thought he should. After all, he hadn't received a beating like that since he started hanging the shirt from his window. How many times had he wanted to do that over the past month, but decided not to? How often had he chosen belligerence over betrayal? I caught up to him leaving school, and since we were both biking the same direction, there wasn't much he could do to ignore me. "Mike, I'm sorry," I said, huffing as I caught my breath. He asked, "Why, it's not your problem." "No, but if I hadn't been so stubborn about going to the cabin, I mean, this wouldn't have happened, right?" Mike indifferently replied, "Who knows?" "Well, I guess what I wanted to say is, I'll go to the cabin again with you if..." "Hey, wait." I paused, a confusing thought having entered my mind. Mike slowed and rolled off the sidewalk to allow other students to pass us. I was glad for the physical break to let my mind run fully. I said, "I thought you'd gone there alone before. Why didn't you just do that?" Mike shrugged and turned his shoulders like he was going to keep riding, but he planted his feet in the grass. When he swayed back to face me, I saw hints of shame and shades of embarrassment in his expression. "Guess it's my turn to apologize," he said. He rocked his bike as he said, "I'm sorry for making you feel crazy about the whole harmonica thing. I guess I was in denial?" He said this last more like a question than a statement. "Truth is, I heard it inside the cabin once too, when I was out there by myself. It sounded like it was right up in the loft and, well, Dad was really bad that day and I was super pissed off and I didn't really care what happened to me, so I actually climbed up there."
"You went in the loft?" I asked.
"Not in it, really, but I stuck my head up there to see if somebody was there. It was stupid, I know."
"Yeah, it was," I half laughed.
Mike's face warmed a little. "Well, I found what was making the noise, kind of. There wasn't anybody up there."
"What was it?"
I asked impatiently. Mike met my eyes with deep sincerity. He wanted to make sure he could trust me. I gave him a subtle nod to continue. "Just a rusty old harmonica in the corner," he said. It was sitting there under a bunch of cobwebs like it hadn't been touched in years. I said, "Well, that doesn't make any sense unless there was another..." "Brandon," Mike interrupted. "I know it doesn't make any sense, okay? It was like middle of the afternoon and there was plenty of light coming through the roof. That old harmonica was the only thing up there." Now, as you'd expect, we went straight to the cabin. Almost. We waited in the woods for a while to see if we might hear the harmonica first, but we didn't, and we didn't hear anything inside the cabin either. The creepy, unwelcome feeling I had when I took Melody there was gone too. Without spoiling the end of my story, which I'll get to very shortly, I think something about Mike and I together, whether it was the reason we found the cabin, the brotherly love we shared, or something else entirely, settled the cabin's ghost down, made it hospitable. I think I upset the ghost when I tried to trespass for something frivolous, my attempted tryst with Melody. And yes, there most certainly was a ghost. I believe the time has come to share how I know. I can't tell you when the last time Mike and I went to the cabin was, because we had no idea it was the last time. Like I said, our visits had gotten way less frequent, and at some point, they just stopped. I mentioned Mike went off to West Point after high school.
I stayed pretty close to home at the University of Northern Iowa. I went back to Sioux Falls to see my family for most holidays, but Mike always stayed in New York. A couple times I offered for him to stay with us, but I think the hassle of traveling that far kept him away. When I came home for Christmas my second year of college, my parents told me some kids had burned down an old tool shed at the end of the street about a month before. It must have happened just after Thanksgiving. Later, I told them I wanted to go for a quick walk and went down to the woods. I wanted to know if that old tool shed was Mike and I's secret cabin. It was. I found the cinderblock hull of our sanctuary where it had so reliably stood through middle and high school. The roof was gone, and the concrete around the windows had been blackened. The frames of our lawn chairs were still inside, as well as the blackened remains of that forgotten bicycle. I sat there, next to the cabin, for a few minutes, and cried. I didn't know I was going to cry until the tears came, and then I couldn't stop them. I suppose it's a good thing I didn't stop them. It felt good to mourn. When I got home, I decided to tell my parents about everything. I needed to talk to someone. My dad told me that the cabin was part of the property on the other side of the hill, and that Mike and I were lucky we never got caught out there. I told him we had no idea, which was true. Seeking more closure, I guess, I went to the house on the other side of the hill the next day and knocked on the door. A gentle-looking older couple answered together. They looked understandably confused, but also, I don't know, hopeful? Expectant, maybe? Anyway, when I mentioned the cabin, they immediately invited me in. First, I apologized for Mike and I's years of trespassing on their property. Then I thanked them. I explained what we had used the cabin for and told them it might literally have saved Mike's life. The woman, Audrey, cried delicately. And I could tell the man, Terry, was trying not to.
Dusty would have been happy to hear this, Terry said. He was our son, and that shed, what you called a cabin, was his. Cancer took him way back when. He wasn't much older than you. He used to work on whatever piqued his interest down there. Sometimes it was wood carving or painting. Sometimes it was fixing stuff up, like bicycles. He played music, too. We used to be able to hear him. Remember that? Terry asked Audrey. She chuckled delightfully.
Oh, yes. How could I forget?
Terry laughed, too. Never was too good at any particular instrument, but he tried anyway. He'd walk around with this harmonica in his pocket. Sometimes we'd hear him blowing into that thing from all the way up here.
Audrey's eyes grew distant, and she said, Sometimes I think I still do.
All of this was so interesting and, on a certain level, terrifying. But I was still hung up on something.
I asked, What did you say your son's name was?
Dustin, Audrey answered.
But we always called him Dusty.
Everyone did, Terry added. I excused myself and told the sweet couple I would be right back. I went straight up to my old room, which had been mostly untouched since I moved out. My dad had shoved some workout equipment in there, but otherwise it was the same. I searched in my closet for an item I only vaguely remembered. I tried to recall whether I had thrown it away since the day I accidentally brought it home. I was almost ready to give up when I found it, fallen down behind my meager sneaker collection in the back corner of the closet. A camo baseball cap with Dusty written on the underpeak. I gave the cap to Audrey and Terry, who accepted it with tearful joy. They told me Dusty had worn that hat almost every day before he started to get really sick. They weren't sure what had happened to it and figured it was gone forever. I explained how I had accidentally taken it home that first day Mike and I found the cabin. They thanked me because, whether I intended to or not, I had saved it from the fire. And I guess that's true. I think now that the reason Mike heard the harmonica when he went out there by himself was because Dusty wanted him to know he wasn't alone. The same tactic he'd used to scare me and Melody away, he used to let Mike know he had a friend. I'm speculating, of course,
but it sure sounds nice, doesn't it? Where Dusty's ghost has gone now, there's no way I'll ever know. But if some small part of him remained connected to that hat, he's with his loving parents now. And that, I think, is about as good an ending as this story, with all its tragedy and sadness, could have.
You made it out. Congratulations. If you enjoyed the story, please rate and review this podcast wherever you like to listen. Reviews are the best way to support the podcast and help it grow. The next best way is to buy merch from thewarningwoods.myshopify.com. The link is also in the description below. If you want more creepy content, follow me on Instagram at thewarningwoods. If you feel ready, meet me here next week for another journey into the Warning Woods. Thank you for listening.
Greetings, adventurers. Today we're excited to introduce you to a new story, Dark Dice, a horror podcast that blurs the line between actual play and audio drama, where the story is determined by the roll of the dice. Six adventurers embark on a journey into the ruinous domain of the Nameless God. They will never be the same again. One of the players is not what they seem after a doppelganger, a creature that can assume the form and voice of whatever it kills, infiltrates the team. As the players are picked off and replaced one at a time, can they figure out who the monster is before it's too late? Can you? Here's a quick example of what our show sounds like.
The shambler with the jar of liquid inside of him.
Soren Arkwright let loose an arrow that cracked the glass, passing through the spine of the creature. The shambler still managed to maintain its forward momentum, but stumbled as it eagerly tried to bite and swipe at Soren, landing near his feet.
As Jeff Goldblum has now joined our cast, Dark Dice is available however you listen to podcasts.